There were perhaps 50 at most out there, that was all. Those were the only survivors who had made it this far in their desperation. Even now stragglers and survivors in various cities were turning on each other, battling as the voice urged them to do, beheading their own former cohorts, cutting out their hearts, smashing their skulls. The cities of the world were filled with black stains upon the pavements, where immortal lives had been snuffed out, and remains had been scorched by the sun. Surely Armand knew that. Gregory did not conceal his own thoughts. "I'm not sorry they're dying," Armand confessed. "But the survivors are what matter now," said Gregory, "and finding a leader. And if you won't be that leader, you, after all your experience..." "What experience?" asked Armand, his brown eyes brightening angrily. "You know what I was, a pawn, an executioner in the thrall of a cult." He paused, then he uttered the words, "The children of Satan," with dark, smouldering rage. "Well, I'm that no longer. Yes, I've driven them out of this city from time to time, and I once drove them all out of New Orleans when Lestat was suffering there, and they were constantly trying to get a glimpse of him. But you'd be surprised if you knew how often I used the mind gift to terrify them, force them into retreat. I did that much more than burn them." His voice trailed away. A blush appeared in his cheeks. "I never took any pleasure in killing any immortal." "Well, maybe whoever leads today will not have to be a wanton executioner," said Gregory. "Maybe the old crude ways of the children of Satan have absolutely nothing to do with this. But you don't want to lead. You know you don't. And Marius does not. Marius can hear us now. He's in there listening to the music. He came in half an hour ago. He has no taste to lead. No, Lestat is the logical one to be the anointed leader." "Anointed?" Armand repeated the word with a slight raise of his eyebrows. "A figure of speech, Armand," said Gregory. "Nothing more. We've waked from those nightmares of the Queen's Blood cult and the later children of Satan. We are finished with such things. We are in thrall to no belief now except what we can know from the physical world around us." "Lestat's savage garden," said Armand. "Not so savage, really," said Gregory. "There is not a single one of us, no matter how old, that does not have a moral heart, an educated heart, a heart that learned to love while human, and a heart that should have learned even more deeply to love as preternatural." Armand looked sad suddenly. "Why has it taken me so long?"
"You're so young yet, you know that," said Gregory. "For 1,000 years I served that wretched queen. I suffered under her mythologies. You haven't even been alive that long in any form. That's what you have to grasp, what all the others have to grasp. You are on the threshold of a great journey, and you must begin to think in terms of what you can do as a powerful spiritual and biological being. Stop with the self-loathing. Stop with imagery of the damned this and the damned that. We are not damned. We never were. Who under the sun has a right to damn any living, breathing creature?"
Armand smiled. "That's what they all love about Lestat," he said. "He says we're damned, and then he behaves as if hell has no dominion over him."
"It should have no dominion over any of us ever," said Gregory. "Now we must talk of all these things, all of us, not just you and I, but all of us. And something must be forged here that will transcend the crisis that's brought us together."
A noise from the front of the house suddenly distracted them. They stood and walked swiftly together down the long hallway and towards the open front doors. The music had broken off. Louis was greeting 2 blood drinkers who had just arrived, and Gregory saw with relief that these were Farid and Seth. Louis had taken their heavy coats, coats for the wind and cold altitudes, and was passing them on now to a quiet, obedient mortal servant who slunk away as if he were invisible. How handsome Louis looked, with his ivory-coloured skin and deep green eyes, this somewhat humble and self-effacing being who had given birth to the books of the Coven of the Articulate.
Lestat might be the hero of the Vampire Chronicles, but this one, Louis, was the tragic heart. Yet he seemed at long last to have achieved a kind of peace with the ghastly realities of his existence, and the existence of all those around him who outranked him in power but not necessarily in insight or wisdom. Farid and Seth were robust and vital as ever, mussed and even flushed from the journey, but obviously glad to be under this roof. Armand came forward with the deliberate dignity of the receiving master of the house, and embraced Farid and then Seth in the French manner with a kiss on both cheeks. Were they distracted by that angelic face? Probably.
"Welcome to our house," Armand said. "We are so glad you've come."
"Unfortunately, the plane's been delayed," said Farid. He was referring to the plane carrying Rose and Victor.
"I am very unhappy. It won't land before sunrise."
"We have people who can meet the plane," said Armand. "Trusted people. They will take care of Rose and Victor. Now come in and rest a while."
"Ah, but we have such people too," Farid said quickly, but not disagreeably. "And please understand, I don't want them under this roof. We'll keep them in our apartments in Midtown for a while."
"This is a secret location?" asked Armand. "We have deep cellars here, inaccessible to mortals and most immortals."
"The boy has a horror of basements and enclosed spaces," said Farid. "I've promised he won't be locked in a crypt. He'll feel much safer in our Midtown rooms."
"And the girl? How much does she know?"
"Everything, really," said Farid. "There was no point in tormenting her with lies."
Armand nodded.
"We'll bring them here," said Seth. "We will allow them to meet everyone."
Farid was obviously shocked. He looked helplessly and a little angrily at Seth.
"If they are to go their own way after this, better they remember us for what we were."
Armand nodded.
"We want to make all of you comfortable in any way that we can."
They passed into the parlour. Sibel's greeting was a quick nod, but Antoine came up with a violin and bow in his left hand to offer his right. Every new encounter with his own kind was treasured by Antoine. Gregory watched as Marius came forward to embrace the two doctors. Ah, so powerful, this commanding Roman who had kept the mother and father safe and secret for 2,000 years. If Marius experienced the slightest fear of his elders gathering here, he showed not the slightest sign. His beloved Chrysanthe, in her white and silver gown, who had been sitting with Marius, in deep conversation with him as far as Gregory could divine, also came forward and gave her tender, most gracious greeting to the newcomers. Far off, in rooms throughout the three townhouses, others were coming to awareness of the latest arrival. Daniel and Arjun and Pandora, who'd been talking together somewhere, and Thorn, red-headed Thorn, who'd only arrived the night before, and had been in fast conversation with David and Jessie. Jessie was in no state to be with the entire company. Rather, she was someone in deep anxiety, and she had related in a trembling voice to Gregory all that Lestat had told her about the images he had caught from Maharit about the Guatemalan volcano, Pacaya. "But my aunt would never doom the entire tribe to extinction, no matter how great her pain," she averred. Then she had given way to tears. Thorn was a friend to her, an old friend, as was David, and they remained closeted away.
"I can show you to your rooms now, if you like," said Louis to Farid and Seth. "Rooms where you might be alone and rest."
He still spoke with a faint French accent, and looked relaxed yet formal in his black wool suit, with a flash of green silk at the neck, a shade of green that exactly matched the emerald ring on his left hand.
"In time," said Farid gratefully with a sigh. "Let us stay here with you, if we might. I heard the music when we were approaching."
"And you shall hear it again," said Sibel,
and with a nod she began again that same vigorous and dark waltz, the carousel waltz. Tall, lanky Antoine had taken his place beside her again, his long black hair loose and unkempt, yet not unattractive, certainly not unattractive for a fiddler. And he began to accompany Sibel, obviously waiting for her to initiate the variations. Flavius and Davis appeared in the doorway. At once the doctor, Farid, greeted Flavius and began asking as to the leg, the miracle leg, and they were lost now in conversation. But Seth had taken one of the many small gold music chairs against the wall, and was staring at Sibel and Antoine as they played together. He seemed oblivious to everyone else. Davis, too, had been distracted and drawn by the music. Chrysanthi suddenly asked Marius if he cared to dance, and he, quite surprised, immediately accepted. This startled Gregory. Indeed, it shocked him.
"If you don't know how to waltz," Chrysanthi was saying, in her naive and innocent fashion, "I'll teach you."
But Marius did know how, he confessed, with a playful smile, and suddenly they were dancing in wide circles across the hardwood floor in the vast, empty room, two stately and charming figures, Chrysanthi with her shimmering bronze hair threaded with pearls and spilling down her back in waves, and Marius staring right into her eyes as he guided her effortlessly in time with the music. He had cut his pale blonde hair short for this evening, and wore the simplest of male attire, a dark dinner jacket and trousers with a white turtleneck sweater. "He is the most impressive immortal here," Gregory thought, "and my Chrysanthi is as beautiful as any, as beautiful as Pandora, who is just now coming into the room. I don't like it, their dancing. I don't like it at all. When had he ever seen blood drinkers dancing? He and Chrysanthi went out into human society frequently and always had, and they had danced, yes, on many a polished dance floor, passing for mortal, but this was wholly different. This was a gathering of immortals, and the dancing of immortals was different." Suddenly the music was too loud for him, and he felt his pulse in his veins, and he didn't want to watch Marius with his blood wife Chrysanthi, but he didn't want to walk away either. From far beyond these walls there came voices in the night, the young blood drinkers out there arguing with one another in the park, and suddenly one of them was fleeing from another in terror. The tempo of the music became ever more rapid. Pandora had begun to dance with Louis, the ancient one with the inevitable living marble demeanour, and the younger, more human Louis, beaming down at her as if she were in fact an ingenue in his care. Recent infusions of ancient blood had not entirely altered Louis. He was still, perhaps, the most human-appearing immortal in the house. Davis moved out onto the dance floor, alone, his head slightly bowed, left arm raised in an arc, right hand on his waist, making his own little private dance to the waltz music with exquisite feline ease. His heavy-lidded eyes were dreamy, and his dark brown skin gorgeous in the light of the chandelier. Farid had taken his place beside Seth, and appeared to be enraptured now with these goings-on. Vampire musicians were such curiosities, and had appeared so seldom in the history of the undead. What they did with their instruments was always so difficult to analyze, but Gregory was convinced it had to do with the changelessness of the vampiric body and the ever-shifting changes all around them. They did not yield to tempo as did human musicians, but kept rebelling against it, playing with it, threatening to destroy it, yet snapping back into it with surprising suddenness, which gave the music a friable and almost tragic sound. Armand was suddenly at Gregory's side.
"Rather like fiddling while Rome burns, isn't it?" he asked.
"Oh, I don't know," said Gregory. "But the intensity of this is undeniable. This many of us gathered here in one place. This is...
I know. But this time we mustn't scatter like marbles rolling in all directions when it's over."
"No," said Gregory. "It's not possible any more for us to live isolated from one another and uncooperative with one another. I've known that for a long time."
"Yes, it's never worked when I've tried." Armand broke off and turned to the music.
Benji came into the room. The music stopped. In his dark grey three-piece suit and matching fedora, Benji moved through the crowd with the smiling vigour of a visiting politician, shaking this hand and that, bowing to Pandora and to Chrysanthi, accepting the kisses of the women graciously, and then taking the centre of the room, eyes sweeping over all. He was perhaps 5 feet 2 inches in height, yet a perfectly proportioned man. His hat was clearly integral to his costume, and no one need bother to tell him that a gentleman takes off his hat indoors, because his hat was not coming off. It was part of him.
"I thank you all for coming," he declared, his boyish voice ringing out clearly and distinctly with a commanding self-confidence. "I've broken off broadcasting to inform you of the following. The voice has called our phone lines.
and spoken to us through the vocal cords of a vampire male. The voice says it is trying to come to us."
"But how can you be certain this was the voice?" asked Armand.
"It was the voice," said Benjy, with a little deferential bow to Armand. "I spoke to him myself, of course, Armand, and he referenced for me the things he had told me privately."
Benjy tapped the side of his head beneath the brim of his hat.
"He recalled for me the bits of poetry he'd been reciting to me telepathically. It was the voice, and the voice says he is struggling with all his might to come to us. Now, ladies and gentlemen of the night, I must return to the broadcast."
"But wait, please, Benjy," said Marius. "I'm at a disadvantage here. What poetry was it exactly that the voice recited?"
"Yeats, master," said Benjy, with a deeper, more referential bow. "Yeats, The Second Coming. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." And he was off without another word for his studio upstairs, tipping his hat as he passed Pandora and Chrysanthi. And the music filled the room again, the throbbing, rushing sound of the Carousel Waltz. Gregory moved back, close to the wall, watching the dancers as they resumed. Then he realized that Davis was at his side. He felt the cool touch of Davis's hand on his.
"Dance with me," said Davis. "Come dance at my side."
"How?"
"Oh, you know. You've always known. The way men have always danced. Think back. Long ago you must have danced with other men."
Davis's eyes were moist, searching. Davis was smiling, and he seemed utterly trusting, trusting in Gregory somehow, no matter what the future held. How sweet was that trust! Gregory did think back, yes. Back and back he went through the memories to those long-ago human nights in ancient Kemet, when he had danced, danced with other men, danced at the banquets of the court until he'd fallen down in bliss and exhaustion with the drums still pounding in his ears.
"Very well," he said to Davis. "You lead the way."
How marvellous it was to be drifting into the ancient patterns, yet bound up in this new romantic music. How natural it suddenly seemed. And though his eyes were half closed, and for a moment all his fear and apprehension was forgotten, he was conscious that other male immortals were dancing too, all around him, each in his own way. Flavius was dancing. Flavius of the miracle limb dancing with that limb. It seemed everyone was dancing, everyone was caught up in this raw and relentless music. Everyone had yielded to it, and to this unprecedented and extraordinary moment that stretched on and on. An hour had passed, maybe more. Gregory wandered the house. The music filled it, seemed to reverberate in the very beams. In an open library, a pretty French library, he saw Pandora talking with Flavius by a gas fire. Flavius was weeping, and Pandora was stroking his head, lovingly, tenderly.
"Oh, yes, but we have time now to talk about all of it," she said to him softly. "I have always loved you. Loved you from the night I made you, and you have always been in my heart."
"There's so much I want to tell you. There's this longing for a continuity, for you to know."
"To be your witness, yes, I understand."
"Still, after all this time, this unimaginable time, I have these fears."
Fears. Gregory passed on silently, not wanting to intrude. Fears. What were his own fears? Was Gregory afraid that in this new coming together they would lose their little family that had endured for so long? Oh, yes. He knew that fear. He'd known it as soon as he'd brought his little company through the front door. But something finer, something greater was possible here, and for that he was willing to take the risk. Even as it chilled him, even as he found himself wandering back towards the music, towards the inevitable spectacle of seeing his beloved Chrysanthi dazzled and entertained by new and magnetic immortals, he knew that he wanted this, this great gathering, more than he had ever wanted anything with his entire soul. Were not all of these immortals here his kin?
could they not all become one united and enduring family?
18. Lestat, Severin, and the Caves of Gold. Millions of years ago, two great volcanoes poured lava and ash again and again over the land now called Cappadocia, creating a stark and breathtaking landscape of serpentine gorges and valleys, and soaring cliffs, and countless clustered knife-like towers of stone piercing the sky, which have come to be known as fairy chimneys. For thousands of years mortals have carved deep cave dwellings into the soft volcanic rock, eventually creating virtual cathedrals underground and monasteries, and even whole cities remote from all natural light. Was it any wonder that a great immortal had created a refuge in this strange land, where tourists now come to see Byzantine paintings in cave churches, and hotels today offer luxurious accommodations in rock-cut rooms in cliff faces and mountain peaks? How gorgeous it was under the light of the moon, this magical land in the middle of the Anatolian plain. But nothing had prepared me for what I beheld as we entered Severin's underground domain. It was just past midnight when we made our way through a narrow, winding, rocky valley, far beyond any human habitation. And how Gabriel found the entrance in what seemed an impenetrable cliff, I wasn't certain. But climbing the face of this cliff, clinging with preternatural skill to the outcroppings and broken roots that humans might never trust, we made our way into a dark slit of an opening that widened out into an actual low-roofed tunnel. Even with my vampiric vision, it was difficult for me to make out the shape of Gabriel moving in front of me, until suddenly, after the fourth or fifth turn in the passage, her figure loomed small and dark against the glow of flickering flames. Two vigorously burning torches marked the entrance into a passage of hammered gold, where the air was suddenly cool with currents from the world beyond, and the shimmering metal all around us enclosed us in an eerie light. On we walked until we reached the first of many broader gold-lined chambers, where layer after layer of the precious metal had been hammered over crude stone, perhaps mixed with fresco plaster, I couldn't know, and suddenly the ceilings above us were ablaze with magnificent paintings in the old Byzantine style that had once filled the churches of Constantinople, and still filled the churches of Ravenna and San Marco in Venice. Rows and rows of dark-haired, round-faced saints gazed down on us with dark brows and unwavering gravity, clothed in embroidered robes, as we moved deeper and deeper into the underground realm. At last we emerged on a gallery that wound around the upper part of a vast, domed space with the feel of a great plaza. All around us passages opened from this great central place to other parts of the seeming city, while above the dome itself was decorated in brilliant sections of green and blue, and gold mosaics swirling with vines and blossoms, bordered in red and gold at the top of the walls. Grecian columns carved out of the soft rock appeared to hold a structure that was in fact part of the mountain. Everywhere the walls lived and breathed with color and ornament. But there were no Christian saints here. The figures that rose from the floor to gaze at us, as we went down the rock-cut stairs, were angelic and glorious, but devoid of all faith iconography. They might have been celebrated members of our people, for all I knew, with their shimmering and perfect faces, and grand robes of crimson or cobalt blue or twinkling silver. Everywhere I saw mixtures of historical motifs, ribbons of egg and dart decoration dividing diamond-shaped panels of multi-petaled flowers, or dark blue night behind symmetrical stars, or painting so vividly real, it seemed a glimpse here and there into a real garden. A great harmony held it all together, and gradually my eyes saw that much that had been done here was ancient and fading, yet other areas were fresh and still smelt of the pigment and plaster recently applied. The whole was a visual wonderland. The lights. I had not noticed it before, but of course all this was seen in a wealth of electric light, streaming from horizontal fixtures tucked everywhere along borders, in corners and beneath the lower rim of the huge dome. The steady brilliance of electric light came from the many doorways.
We had come to a stop now on the marble-tiled floor of this huge piazza-like place. I could feel the fresh air moving around us. It smelled of the night beyond, of water and green things. From one of the doors came a figure to greet us, a blood-drinker who resembled a young woman of perhaps 20. Oval face and oval eyes, and a complexion like cream.
"Lestat and Gabrielle?" she said as she drew near, her hands extended to include both of us. "I'm Bianca. Marius is Bianca from Venice."
"Of course, I should have known you immediately," I said. She felt soft and tender to me, remarkably so, in fact, considering she had 500 years in the blood, and plenty of the blood of the mother. All those years with Marius, during which he protected the shrine of those who must be kept, she'd drunk that precious blood. And she'd been made by Marius, and all those made by Marius had been well made, much better made than my fledglings. I hadn't known to take and give the blood over and over, as Marius had always done. Bianca wore a simple black robe trimmed in gold, and her long hair was braided with what seemed a leafy vine of gold. And a delicate gold circlet around her head made me think of the painting the mortal painter Botticelli had done of her.
"You come with me, please, both of you," she said.
We followed her down another corridor of splendid gold enameling, bordered in delicately wrought flowering trees with blossoms like jewels, and into another large and splendid chamber. Behind a long, heavy wooden table with carved legs sat Sevrain, who rose now to greet us. It had to be Sevrain. Indeed, it was the same powerful and ancient immortal I'd seen rising out of the tunnel in Paris. She was a strongly built figure, with fine, high breasts in what seemed a Roman gown of sheer rose fabric crisscrossed with gold ribbons and bound around the waist. With a mane of flowing light blonde hair, she looked Nordic, and her pale blue eyes underscored the impression. She was big-boned but beautifully shaped all over, down to her tapering fingers and her lush, naked arms. But before I could fully absorb this miracle, this vision, this creature who was reaching across the table now and inviting us to sit down, I was distracted by two figures who flanked her. One, a female blood drinker I knew but couldn't place, a woman taken in her prime with remarkably long, dark, ashen hair, hair that was almost a luminous gray, and clever, vibrant eyes. And the other, a spirit. I knew at once it was a spirit, but it was not like any other spirit I'd seen up close before. It was a spirit clothing himself in actual physical particles, a body of particles that it had made up, somehow, and drawn to itself out of dust, air, free-floating bits of matter. And it was so solidly put together, the physical vehicle of this spirit, that it was wearing actual clothes. This was wholly different from the apparitions of ghosts and spirits I'd known in the past, and I had seen some powerful ghosts and spirits, including the spirit who had called himself Memnoch the Devil, in differing forms. But they had been hallucinations, those ghosts and spirits with their clothes being a part of the illusion, and even the scent of blood and sweat or the sound of a heartbeat had been part of the illusion. When they'd smoked a cigarette, or drunk a glass of whiskey, or given off the sound of a footstep, it had been part of the apparition. The whole vision had been of a different texture than the world around it, the world I inhabited and from which I'd seen it. Oh, so I believed. Not so at all with this spirit. His body, whatever it was made of, was occupying three-dimensional space and had weight. I could hear the sounds of simulated organs inside it, hear the distinct beating of a heart, hear the respiration. I could see the light of the room actually falling on the planes of this spirit's face, see it glittering in his eyes, see the shadow of his arm on the table. No scent, however, except that of incense and perfume which clung to its clothes. Maybe I had, in fact, seen such spirits as this, but only fleetingly in the past, and never close enough or long enough to realize that they could be touched, that they were being seen by others. I felt sure this one had never been a human being. He wasn't a ghost.
No, he had to be something originating in some other realm, for the simple reason that his body was wholly ideal, like a work of Greek classical art, and there was nothing about it that was particular. In sum, this was the best spirit body I'd ever beheld, and he was smiling at me, apparently pleased with my quiet but obvious fascination. He had dark and wavy and perfect hair framing his face in a classical Greek style, and the face could easily have come from a Greek statue. Yet this thing lived and breathed in the body it had assembled for itself. I had no idea how it could have a heartbeat, how the blood could rush to its face now, or appear to do so, as I smelled no actual blood, but it was a splendid spirit. We had come to the edge of the table. It was perhaps 3 feet wide, of a wood so old I could smell the generations of oil worked into it. There were playing cards out on the wood, bright, pretty, glittering playing cards.
"Welcome to you both," said Severin. She spoke in a sweet, lyrical voice with a girl's enthusiasm. "I'm so happy you've come, Lestat. You don't know how many nights I've heard you out there roaming this land, wandering about the ruins of Göbekli Tepe. And I always dreamed you would find your way here, that you would hear something emanating from these mountains that would prove irresistible to you. But you seemed alone, dedicated to being alone, not eager at all to have your thoughts interrupted. And so I've waited and waited. And your mother and I have long known each other, and she at last has brought you here."
I didn't believe a word she was saying. She coveted her secrecy. She was merely trying to be polite, and I was bound to be polite as well. "Maybe this is the perfect time, Severin," I said. "I'm happy to be here." The mysterious woman had arisen at Severin's right, and so had this male spirit on her left.
"Ah, young one," said the woman,
and immediately I knew this voice from the charnel house under Paris.
"You have ridden the devil's road with greater zeal than any I've ever known. You don't know how many nights from my grave I followed you, catching one image of you after another from the minds that doted on you. I dreamed of waking merely to talk to you. You burnt like a flame in the blackness in which I suffered, beckoning me to rise."
A chill came over me. I took both her hands.
"The old one," I said in a whisper, "from Les Innocents, the one who was with Armand and the children of Satan."
I was astonished.
"You're the one I called the old queen." "Yes, beloved one. I'm Alessandra," she said. "That's my name. Alessandra, daughter of Dagobert, last king of the Merovingians and brought into the blood by Rosamandis. Oh, what a splendid pleasure it is to behold you here in this safe and warm place."
These names powerfully excited me. The history of the Merovingians I knew, but who was this blood-drinker Rosamandis? Something told me I'd soon find out. Not here, perhaps, but somewhere, and in short order, as the old ones, like Severin, continued to let down their guard. I wanted to embrace this woman. The table stood between us. I had half a mind to crawl over it. Instead, I squeezed her hands ever more tightly. My heart was pounding. This moment was too precious.
"You were like a Cassandra in that doomed old coven," I said. My words came in a rush.
"Oh, you don't know the sadness I felt when they told me you were dead. They said you'd gone into the flames. I tell you, it was anguish I felt. I had so wanted to take you out of those catacombs and into the light. I had so wanted—"
"Yes, young one, I remember. I remember all."
She sighed and lifted my fingers to her lips, kissing them as she went on. "If I was Cassandra in those nights, I was unheeded and unloved even by myself."
"Oh, but I loved you," I confessed.
"And why did they say you'd gone into the fire?"
"Because I did, Lestat," she said. "But the fire would not have me, did not kill me, and I tumbled down and down amid smoking timbers and old bones as I wept,
too weak to rise, and was finally entombed with the remains of the cemetery beneath Paris. I didn't know my own age then, beloved. I didn't know my gifts or my strength. It was the way, then, of the very ancient to pass in and out of history, and in and out of lunacy. And I think there are others still in those tunnels beneath the city. Ah, what an agony, that slumber amid whispers and howls! Your voice was the only voice that ever actually pierced my uneasy dreams. How lovely she was, the flower of the twisted old stem she'd been then. I muttered something about how I'd longed even back then to see what she could have been. I stopped myself. It was so presumptuous and selfish. She was restored, after all. She was here, vital, vibrant, part of this new and astonishing age. But she didn't correct me. She didn't shrink from me. She only smiled. Severin was pleased with all this. And this woman, who hardly seemed old at all now, nothing like the wretched hag she'd been in those 18th-century nights, was flushed with pleasure. Finally, I put my knee on the table and leaned forward and clasped Alessandra's face in my hands and kissed her. In those earlier times, she'd been doomed, a dead thing in medieval garb, even to a filthy and ragged veil and wimple. Now her healthy, silvery, ashen hair was free and came down in dark waves over her shoulders. The robe she wore was fresh and soft like that of Severin, only it was a pale green. A green like the grass of the world of the day, that bright and beautiful. Around her neck was a single bright ruby on a chain. Alessandra, daughter of Dagobert. Her lips were dark and red, like that ruby. What a monster she'd appeared back in those nights. A face deformed by madness like the face of my maker Magnus. But she was free now, freed by time, freed by survival to be something else, something entirely different and wondrous and sweet and vital. Yes, young one, yes, and thanks to you, your voice, your videos and songs, your desperate revelations, I have slowly come back to myself. But I've been a pawn of this voice. I have been the dupe of this voice. Her face darkened, and for a moment it seemed to crumple into that of the medieval horror she'd been before. Only now I am in the helping hands of others. Put that aside, said Bianca. She was still beside me on my right, with Gabrielle on my left. It is over, said Bianca. The voice will not triumph. But she was trembling with some sort of inner conflict, some battle between anguish and optimism. Severin turned slowly to the spirit. He had stood quite still all this time, regarding me with his bright but quiet blue eyes, as if he could actually see through them, process through them all that lay before him. He wore a fancy, glittering, decorative Indian garment called a shawani, a kind of robe that went down to his ankles, I supposed, though I couldn't see below the top of the table, and his skin was amazingly realistic. Nothing as synthetic-looking as our skin always looks, but natural-looking skin made up of tiny changing pores and the soft down that covers humans. "Cramped strike her nose," he said, extending his hand. "But Cramped is my simple and true name. Cramped is my name for you and for all those I love." "And you love me?" "Why?" I asked. But it was thrilling to be talking to this spirit. He laughed, softly and politely, unshaken by my sharp question. "Doesn't everyone love you?" he asked sincerely. It was as human a voice as I'd ever heard, tenor in pitch, even. "Isn't everyone hoping for you to somehow lead the tribe when this present war has been brought to the finish?" I looked at Severin. "Do you love me?" I asked. "Are you hoping for me to lead this tribe?" "Yes," she said with a radiant smile. "I am hoping and praying you will lead it. Surely you cannot expect me to lead it?" I sighed. I looked at my mother. "We do not have to talk about this right now," my mother said. But there was something about her remote, half-lidded regard of me that chilled me. "Don't worry.
she crooned with a cold, ironic smile. "No one can crown you Prince of the Vampires against your will, can they?" "Prince of the Vampires?" I scoffed. "I don't know," I said. I looked back at the others. I wished I had a full night to take in all of these revelations, these new and startling encounters, just to try to fathom the limits of this splendid Severin, or why the tender Bianca was suffering so because she couldn't conceal the pain.
"But I'll tell you that why I am suffering," Bianca said, drawing near but talking in a normal and not a confidential voice, her arms slipping around me. "I lost one I loved in the attack in Paris. A young one, one I'd made and lived with for decades. But this was the voice at work, not the one he'd brought out of the earth to do his bidding." "And that was I," said Alessandra, "roused by the voice, and given the unholy strength by the voice to climb out of that tomb of bones and filth. That sin lies on me."
I saw it now in horrific, flickering images, a wraith of a woman, a macabre skeleton of a creature with hag hair, sending a fatal jet of heat at the house in the Rue Saint-Jacques, and revenants rushing to their very doom as they fled the doors and windows right into the path of the murderous power. I saw Bianca down on her knees on the pavement, wailing, hands pressed to the side of her head, face upturned. I saw the wraith approach and reach out for her, as if the very personification of death had paused in its rounds to show compassion to one lone soul.
"Many have been duped by the voice," said Gabrielle, "and not so many have survived it and turned away with such immediate disgust. That counts for much, as far as I'm concerned."
"It counts for everything," said Bianca gravely.
Alessandra's face was sad. She appeared to be dreaming, to have slipped away from the present time and back into a great, limitless gulf of darkness. I wanted to reach out and take her hand, but it was Severin who did this. All the while the spirit, Gremt Stryker Knowles, gazed on without a word. He was seated now as he had been before. Others were coming into this large room. For a moment I didn't believe my eyes. There was a ghost there, surely it was a ghost, in the person of an elderly man with dark grey hair and skin that suggested mother-of-pearl to me. He was in a body as solid as the body of the spirit Gremt, and he, too, wore real clothes. Breathtaking. And two exquisitely groomed and exquisitely dressed female blood-drinkers were with him. When I saw who they were, who they actually were, these two with their coiffed hair and soft silken robes, I started crying. They came at once to me, and both embraced me.
"Eleni and Eugenie," I said, "safe after all this time."
I could hardly speak. Somewhere in a chest, locked away, a chest that had survived neglect and fire, I still had in my possession all the letters once written to me from Paris by Eleni. The letters that had told me of the Théâtre des Vampires in the Boulevard du Temple that I had left behind in my wanderings. The letters that told me of its prosperity with the Paris audiences, of Armand's governance, and of the death of my Nicolas, my second fledgling, my only mortal friend, and my greatest failure. This was Eleni, and her companion Eugenie, fresh and perfumed and quietly resplendent in their simple silk garments. They were dark-eyed, with soft, almond-colored skin and dark hair loose over their shoulders. And I had thought them long gone from the earth, gone in this or that catastrophe, a mere memory of the century of white, powdered wigs consumed by time and violence.
"Come, let's all sit down together," said Severin.
I looked around, a bit dazed, a bit uncertain. I wanted somehow to sink into some shadowy corner and think about what was happening, absorb what was happening, but there was no time or place for this. I was shaken and at a loss. Indeed, I was overwhelmed when I contemplated how many other reunions and shocks awaited me. But how could I shrink from this? How could I resist it? Yet if this was what we all wanted, if this is what we dreamed of in our grief and our loneliness, being reunited with those we'd lost,
then why was I finding it so very hard? The ghost, the puzzling ghost of the elderly man with the dark grey hair, had taken a seat beside Grant, and he sent me a quick, sharp, telepathic introduction. Raymond Gallant. Did I know that name? Eleni and Eugenie went around the table and sat beside Alessandra. I saw a hearth now to the far left, well stacked with burning logs, though the light of the fire was lost in the great electric illumination of this golden room with its twinkling and flickering walls and ceiling. I saw a multitude of things, sconces, bronze sculptures, heavy carved chests, but nothing registered for the moment except that I was suffering a kind of paralysis. I worked against it. I had to look at the faces that surrounded me. I took the empty, high-backed chair opposite Severin. That's what she wanted. Gabrielle sat beside me, and it was quite impossible to ignore that I was the center of attention, that all these beings were connected by earlier encounters, or even long history, and that I had much to learn. I found myself looking at this ghost. And then the name hit me. Raymond Gallant. Talamasca. A friend to Marius in the Renaissance years, before and after Marius had been attacked by the children of Satan and his Venetian palazzo destroyed, a friend who had actually helped him, through the Talamasca, find his beloved Pandora, who'd been traveling Europe in those nights with an Indian blood-drinker named Arjun. Raymond Gallant had died in very old age, in an English castle belonging to the Talamasca, or so Marius had always believed. The ghost was looking at me now with the most genial eyes, smiling eyes, friendly eyes. His clothes were the only decidedly Western garb in the room besides mine. A simple dark suit and tie, and yes, absolutely, they were real, these garments, not part of his complex and marvelously realized artificial body. "Are you ready to join the others in New York?" asked Severin. She had a simplicity and directness that reminded me of my mother, and I could hear that powerful heart of hers beating, that ancient heart. "And what good would that do?" I asked. "How can I affect what's happening?"
"Plenty," she said. "We must all go there. We must all come together. The voice has contacted them. The voice wants to join them."
I was shocked and skeptical. "How is that possible?"
"I don't know," she said, "and they don't know either. But the voice has endorsed Trinity Gate in New York as the place for us to meet. We must go there."
"What about Maharet?" I asked. "And what about Cayman? How can the voice—"
"I know what you're saying," said Severin. "And again I am saying that we must gather under Armand's roof. No one of us can stand against Maharet and Cayman. I've been to their encampment. I've tried to talk with Maharet. She would not admit me. She would not listen to me. And with Cayman beside her, I can't prevail against her. Not alone, only with others. And the others are meeting in New York."
I bowed my head. I was shaken by what she was saying. Surely it wasn't coming to that, a battle of the ancients, a battle involving force. But then what other kind of battle would it be? "Well, then let the great children of the millennia gather," I said. "But I'm no child of the millennia."
"Oh, come now, Lestat," she answered. "You've drunk the mother's blood in staggering amounts, and you know it. You have an indomitable will that counts for a supernatural gift in itself."
"I was Akasha's dupe," I said. I sighed. "So much for will. I have indomitable emotions. That's not the same as having indomitable will."
"Now I know why they call you the Brat Prince," said Severin patiently. "You're going to New York, and you know you are."
I didn't know what to say. What could it conceivably mean that the voice meant to join a New York meeting if the voice was emanating from Mercari? Would the voice somehow, through Cayman, force the twins to travel to New York? I couldn't figure it. And what of Maharet envisioning that volcano and their fiery finish? Did the others know about that? I didn't dare to think of it in this company of minds that could rake mine with total ease.
"Believe me," said Severin, I offered my presence, my sympathy, and my strength to Maharit only nights ago, and I was rebuffed. I have told her in plain words who the voice is, and she has refused to believe it. She insists the voice cannot be what we know it is. Maharit is a bruised and broken soul now. Maharit cannot stop this thing. She cannot fathom that the voice is coming from her own sister. Maharit is ruined.
I can't give up on her that easily, I said. I understand what you're saying. It's true. I went there and tried to talk with her, and she forced me to leave. She used her power to physically push me away, quite literally. But I can't give up on her as broken and bruised. That can't be right. The last time when we all faced annihilation, she and Makari saved us. We would all have died if... Look, we ought to go to her now. You, me, Marius, whoever else we can find, say this to them when we meet, all of us, under Armand's roof, Severin said. But I was horror-struck at the thought of what might be happening in that jungle compound now. What if the voice, through Cayman, found some way to do away with Maharat? It was unthinkable to me, and equally unthinkable that I might stand by and let this happen.
I know this, said Severin. She was responding to my thoughts. I am fully aware of it. But as I told you, this creature's destiny has been fulfilled. Maharit's found her twin, and in her twin she's confronted the nothingness, the emptiness, the sheer meaninglessness of life that all of us face sooner or later, and maybe more than once, and maybe even many times. Maharit has not survived this final encounter. She has divorced herself from her mortal family. She has nothing now to sustain her. The tragedy of her mindless sister Makari has devoured her. She's finished.
You go join the others, I said. I'll go back to the Amazon now, and I'll take my stand with her. I can reach there before sunrise in that hemisphere. No, you mustn't do this. It was the voice of the spirit, Gremt. He was still sitting quite calmly to Severin's left, as before. You're needed at the conclave, and that's where you must go. If you return to Maharit's sanctuary now, she'll only drive you away again, and she may do worse.
Forgive me, I said, straining to be courteous. But what has this to do with you?
I knew this spirit, Amal, he answered, for thousands of years before he came into the physical. If he had not come, not fused with Akasha, I might never have come, never have sought to take on a body and walk on the earth in the guise of a human. I've been prompted in all I've done by him, by his descent into flesh and blood, and my own love of flesh and blood. I followed him here.
Well, that's a staggering revelation, I said.
And how many others like you are roaming around this earth, may I ask, watching this pageant for pleasure?
I'm not watching the pageant for pleasure, he replied.
And if there are others from our realm who've concerned themselves with these events, they haven't made their presence known to me.
Stop, please, Severin implored me. It will all make more sense to you if you realize this being founded the Talamasca. Now, you know the Talamasca. You know their principles. You know their high-minded goals. You know their dedication. You loved and trusted David Talbot when he was still the superior general of the Talamasca, a mortal scholar who did all in his power to be your friend. Well, Gremt Stryker Knowles founded the Talamasca. And that should answer all your questions as to his character. I don't know what other word to use but character. You need not doubt Gremt.
I was speechless. Of course I'd always known that some supernatural secret burned at the heart of the Talamasca, but what it was I'd never been able to fathom, and to the best of my knowledge David did not know. And neither did Jessie, who had also been a child of the Order, long before her aunt Maharit had brought her into the blood.
Trust in me, said Gremt. I am on your side now. I fear Amal. I have always feared him. I have always dreaded the day he would come into his own. I listened patiently, but said nothing.
Tomorrow at sunset we should all leave here together, said Severin, and there I find those as old as I am, as powerful. I'm convinced of it.
This conclave will draw them there and under moral constraints which I welcome and respect. Perhaps some have already arrived, and then we'll be in a position to determine what to do.
And meanwhile, I said softly, Maharit grapples with this on her own. I sought to banish all images of that volcano, Pacaya, in Guatemala, where our collective destiny might just end.
Severin's eyes locked on mine. Had she seen it?
Of course I know your fears, but why frighten the others? We do what we must do.
Maharit will accept no one's help, said Gremt. I too went to her. It was no use. I knew her when she was a mortal woman. I spoke to her when she was a mortal woman. I was among the spirits who listened to her voice. His voice remained even, but he was becoming emotional. Emotional as any genuine human being. And now, after all this time, she does not trust me, or listen to me. She cannot. In her mind she lost the voices of the spirits when she entered the blood. And any spirit who seeks to incarnate as I've done, she can't trust. She can only regard me with abhorrence and fear. He stopped as if he couldn't continue. I've always somehow known that she would turn her back on me when I stood before her, when I confessed to her that it was I who'd... And now he could not say anything more. His eyes were glazed with tears. He sat back and appeared to take a deep breath, seeking to silently collect himself, and he pressed the fingers of his right hand hard against his own lips. Why was this so seductive to me? So fascinating? Our emotions came from our minds, did they not, yet softened or hardened our physical bodies? And so his powerful spirit agitated this artfully made physical form in which he resided, with which he had become one. I felt drawn to him. I felt that he was no alien thing at all, but something very like us. A mystery whole unto himself, of course, but very like us. I have to go to Maharit, I said. I started to rise. I have to stand with her now. You go to the conclave, of course, but I'm going to her.
Sit down, said Gabriel.
I hesitated, and then very reluctantly obeyed. I did want to reach the Amazon with hours to spare.
There are other reasons why you should come with us, said Gabriel, in the same firm voice.
Oh, I know, don't tell me, I said angrily. They want me there. The young ones are clamoring for me to go. They attach some special importance to me. Armand and Louis want me to come. Benji wants me to come. I've heard it over and over.
Well, all that is true, said Gabriel. And we are a quarrelsome and independent species, and we do need any charismatic leader who is willing to take the helm. But there are other reasons.
She looked at Severin. Severin nodded, and Gabriel went on. You have a mortal son there, Lestat, a young man of less than 20 years. His name is Victor. He knows you are his father. He was born of a mortal woman in Farid's laboratory, a woman named Flannery Gilman, who is now in the blood. But your son is not in the blood. Silence. Not only did I not speak, I couldn't think. I couldn't reason. I must have looked like someone who has lost his senses. I stared at Gabrielle and then at Severin. I had no words for what I was feeling. I had no way to comprehend the scope of what was going on, not in my mind, but in my heart. I could feel the eyes of all present on me. But it didn't much matter. I looked at them, but I didn't really see them or care about them. Alessandra sitting there staring at me quietly, with Bianca beside her, a picture of sympathy and sadness, and Eleni watching me fearfully, with Eugenie all but hiding behind her, and the spirit and the ghost, with such emotional expressions. A son. A mortal son. A living, breathing son of my flesh. Oh, Farid. He must have planned it from the start with that enticing bedroom, and the warm, sweet-faced Dr. Flannery Gilman, so ready with her tender, mortal mouth and her hot, naked limbs. I'd impregnated her.
The possibility had never occurred to me. Not for one second had I thought such a thing possible. From Severin's mind there came a fully realized image of this boy. He was looking directly at me in this image, a young man with my square face and somewhat short nose, and my unruly blonde hair. Those blue eyes seemed